Bernie Sanders, Alexandra Hamilton, and James Fallows. Not a bad lineup, I'd say. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is November the 18th. Today is Wednesday. Good, as always, to have you here, everybody. How about we do this as we get going here? We're going to take 90 seconds or so, and instead of the news of today, we will tell you what is going to happen tomorrow, because we can. Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is set for a big speech at Georgetown University come Thursday. He will talk, as might be expected given the events of the past week, about foreign policy for a bit. But the Sanders campaign is billing the speech as, and this is their quote, an address on democratic socialism in America. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains exactly what that might mean.
If you ask 10 different people what they think democratic socialism is, chances are you'll get 10 different answers. We reached out to the Sanders campaign but didn't hear back, so I asked two political science professors to define democratic socialism. Samuel Goldman of George Washington University told me it was
achieving collective control of the economy.
Andre Markovitz of the University of Michigan says democratic socialism is an attempt to create
a property-free socialist society.
So everything is communally owned. Senator Sanders has touched on democratic socialism in stump speeches like this one in Iowa last month.
And you call your fire department or the police department, what do you think you're calling? These are socialist institutions.
That Sanders' attempt to use fire and police departments to define democratic socialism does not sit well with Professor Markovitz.
If he were to write this on an exam for me, that's an F.
Sanders has also cited Denmark as a place where democratic socialism has worked. That gets a rise out of Professor Goldman. With apologies to Shakespeare, he says there's something rotten in Sanders' assertions about the state of Denmark.
I would not call that socialism.
Or even democratic socialism. Professor Markovitz agrees. Ultimately, Markovitz says there's no private property at all under democratic socialism. He says it doesn't exist anywhere, and it's an unattainable goal. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so back to the foreign policy news of the week. There has been a whole lot of talk here and elsewhere about Syrian refugees. More than half of American governors are worried enough about them to say they don't want any of them in their states. Those governors say it's just too risky, given Paris. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the way Europe is processing migrants and refugees right now is very different from what we do here.
European countries are overwhelmed with migrants and refugees, so their security checks on people coming in haven't been as stringent. In the U.S., refugees are put through background checks and interviews before they even get here.
And this would all be taking place over, you know, anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years. It's a very, very long process.
American University's Sarah Deardorff Miller has worked with refugee agencies in the U.S. and abroad. She says refugees are screened by the U.N., the State Department, the FBI, and others.
Logically, if you think about it, it would be among the worst ways to try to come if you were wanting to commit an act of terror, if not just because it's such a lengthy process, but it's also among the most stringent of security processes.
Plus, there are easier ways to get here. Stephen Yale Layer teaches law at Cornell University.
Refugees are screened much more thoroughly than many, in fact, most people who come to the United States as tourists or as students.
People still go through background checks, but it's a much less thorough investigation.
They fill out an application online and have an interview at a U.S. consulate or embassy overseas.
But he admits no system is completely risk-free, and America's governors want more assurances that what happened in France won't happen here. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
More, I'm sure, to come on that story. But now, moving on, there are on this planet just two developed countries that let drug companies advertise their products directly to consumers: New Zealand and us, as you know if you've seen TV. The pharmaceutical industry spends $4.5 to $5 billion a year on those ads. Ads that doctors say drive up drug prices and drive patients to ask for medicines they have seen on TV to be prescribed. At its big meeting in Atlanta yesterday, the American Medical Association called for a ban on direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs and medical devices. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Recently, a patient contacted Wanda Filer, a family physician in York, Pennsylvania, about a mysterious condition.
She first told me it was OIC. I had no idea what that was.
Filer's patient was on painkillers and had seen an ad like this.
So go on. Talk to your doctor about opioid-induced constipation.
And ask if once-daily Movantik is right for you.
Filer says the ad gave the woman something unnecessary to worry about.
But she actually didn't have that problem. Her symptoms were very well controlled.
The American Medical Association says prescription drug ads are boosting demand for expensive and sometimes inappropriate treatments and pushing up drug prices. Ian Spatz is a former Merck executive and now a consultant with Manat Health Solutions. He says drug prices aren't based on production or advertising costs.
They're based on what a company perceives as the value in the marketplace and what people are willing to pay for a medicine.
Even so, Spatz says,
there are good arguments that it encourages the use of drugs that may be more expensive than alternatives that are available.
Julie Donahue with the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health has studied direct-to-consumer drug advertising for 15 years. She says even if the federal government were to ban the ads,
it's very unlikely that a ban would stand up to a legal challenge, which would almost certainly be mounted by both the pharmaceutical industry and media.
Just imagine the nightly news without Cialis and Humira. Donahue says if drug companies couldn't advertise directly to us, they'd probably just spend more money pitching our doctors. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You've noticed all those disclaimers at the end of drug ads, right? All the scary bits? We have put together a supercut of them that you can watch. It lives at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, turns out traders love them. Some Federal Reserve. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to rain out west this winter, probably a lot, with a way stronger than normal El Nino in the forecast. Here in Los Angeles, with rising numbers of homeless people camping in the open, often in dry, for now, riverbeds, the city and county have spent a couple of $1 million to get winter shelters ready early. Advocates are working together with law enforcement to relocate some of the most vulnerable out there. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, that is way easier said than done.
Coyote Creek is a tributary of the San Gabriel River. This section of the riverbed has been lined with concrete. It's as wide as a two-lane road, and it's almost completely dry. The team from People Assisting the Homeless, or PATH, approach a campsite that's hidden under a bridge.
Good morning. Anybody home? We're outreach workers.
I'm going to
leave a flyer.
Around 800 people in Los Angeles County are estimated to live in riverbeds and flood channels, and they intentionally make themselves hard to find.
Hello, is anybody home? Hello?
This storm pipe is about 4 feet diameter, easily big enough for someone to crawl into, and people obviously do. Graffiti covers the inside of the pipe for a few feet before it gets completely dark. I ask PATH outreach worker Jorge Guzman, do you think someone is living in there?
My guess is maybe there is somebody back there somewhere, but I wouldn't go back there.
On top of being elusive, the river dwellers are often mobile. 26-year-old Carlos Santos is a migrant worker from Guerrero, Mexico. The team finds him sleeping on a crude scaffold in the support beams under the bridge, about 20 feet above the riverbed. Jorge shouts up at him.
¿Qué tal si se llena tanto que no pueda salir de ahí?
He warns Carlos that the river could rise so high that he would be trapped.
No vamos a estar mucho tiempo aquí. Vamos a tratar de sobresalir adelante.
Carlos says he's just passing through in search of work, and he'll be gone before the next storm. When people refuse to leave, law enforcement will come through and sweep everyone out. But it doesn't last. Tomas Bobby Skevich is one of the PATH outreach guys. He points to four red shopping carts parked in front of a culvert.
This area has been cleaned just recently, so it looks like the people just moved in. For the past couple of days, they've been moving in. That's why they brought the shopping carts and brought their belongings from another area.
So there are constantly new people living in the riverbeds who need to be warned. And some need to hear the message more than once. The team finds a 65-year-old man camped in front of a storm pipe and tell him about the services available.
Please consider our offer, you know, the shelter.
Yeah, yeah, like no, I'm interested in that.
It's free.
I'm interested in that.
But it's not clear that the message gets through. The man seems a little disoriented, and a few minutes later...
Si yo volara igual que una paloma.
I find him singing to pigeons under the bridge. He won't be going to the shelter today. But tomorrow, he might be ready. Meredith Berkson is director of programs at PATH. She says outreach workers will come back to visit people again and again.
We find that it takes at least 5 contacts usually to get someone to come with us to the DMV or go to the Social Security office to get the required documentation to move forward on a housing plan.
But that idea of a housing plan is relative. Frank Anigas says he's been camping on the bank of Coyote Creek for 2 years. What are you going to do if it starts raining really hard this winter?
I run for cover, get shelter or something.
But just temporarily, or would you move into a shelter?
No, temporarily.
Come back here?
Yeah.
Later, I meet guys in the winter shelter who say the same thing. They plan to wait out the rainy season indoors and in the spring move back to the streets. In La Mirada, California, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
About a year and a half ago, we went down to Columbus, Mississippi for a couple of days with Jim Fallows from The Atlantic Magazine, working on the series we are doing with him and his wife Deb called American Futures. They fly around the country in their own plane. We join in every now and then, and we try to figure out what the American economy looks like slice by slice. We were in Columbus because, honestly, 10 or 15 years ago, things hadn't been so good there. Jobs had gone overseas, factories had closed, downtown was run down. And then in 2006... they landed a contract with Airbus. Joe Max Higgins, the head of the economic development team in the Golden Triangle, as it's called, had the money quote on this.
People viewed us as, you know, the guys are dipping snuff with no teeth. The girls are pregnant with no shoes. We can't read and write, and half the people burn a cross in somebody's yard on Friday or Saturday night for fun. That's how the world would view us. And all of a sudden, we were building stuff that flies.
And build they did, almost $5 billion in new investment, 6,000 jobs worth in the past decade. There's a giant steel plant there now. And at the spot where we were talking to Joe Max Higgins, a Yokohama tire factory. All right, so I'm telling you all that so I can tell you this. One of the things we're doing with this series is tracking how places are doing over time. And Jim and his wife were just down in Columbus to see how things are going now. So we got him on the phone. Hey, Jim, good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
Just back from Columbus, Mississippi, I have so many questions, not the least of which is, how are the people down there? Joe Max, the guy who showed us around, all of those folk?
Joe Max, Brenda Latham, Raj Saunak, all the people from Mississippi School of Math and Sciences.
Yeah.
It's the same cast of characters you would recognize, and they're all doing well. And they actually, the story of how the region has changed in the last year and a half is basically positive for most of them.
Talk to me then about some of the big things that you and I did when we were down there. The first one is that tire factory that we went out to see, which was they were still breaking ground on it, Yokohama Tire Plant.
Yes, they were just barely clearing the ground for this, I think, 500-acre site, which just last month opened up. And we couldn't even get in to see it because we had a video crew from The Atlantic with us. And the machinery they have in there is, according to Yokohama, the most advanced they have any place. So it's about a $300 million plant. They've opened it up. They have about 200 people working there now, and they plan to expand to about 500 total employees when they go through another building project in the next year or so.
We also went to a decidedly more low-tech place. That steel plant that was owned by the Russians, which was frankly like something out of the gates of hell. It was amazing. is it it's still up and running and all of that?
It is still up and running. It's now, I think listeners will be excited to hear, it's now under purely American ownership. It was sold to a company based in Indiana called Steel Dynamics Incorporated. So it's no longer Severstal. It's now SDI. And something really interesting about this plant to me is that you and I both marveled at just the molten metal flying every place and the way you felt like you're going to light on fire. The company says this is the most modern mini mill of its type in the world. And in North America, it has the most modern electric arc furnaces. And they're doing a strong business, too. That they're shipping a lot of stuff to new industries in the South and to Mexico, too. So they are there. They're under American ownership, and they're running a full tilt.
Okay, so now do that thing that you have done throughout this series for us, which is draw the bigger picture from what you're seeing on the ground economically. You've got the tire plant, you've got Severstal Steel or whatever it's owned by now. They're doing well. What about the rest of the place, and what about, I guess the social fabric is the phrase to use.
It's a part of the country that in ways people there understand better than anyone else does has been backward, divisive, has had terrible politics and terrible violence and race relations over the decades, over the centuries, still poor, still a lot of people who are unemployed, still very high welfare dependent, still ranked number 49 or 50 in the nation by a number of measures. And I think we asked people that setting the balance question. And one of the things they said is that not just in Mississippi, but across the South, the development model they've had in this golden triangle of Mississippi, of trying to bring in some big industries, of tying them very closely with a community college, this Eastern Mississippi Community College, so they can train local people who'd been laid off, who maybe never had had jobs for these relatively high-wage industrial and skilled tech jobs, that's a model they're trying to replicate across the state and elsewhere. So they're being studied as a success story in a difficult circumstance. So the challenge in describing this part of the country is how to place in proper perspective the things that are getting better in a region that is still has some of the most serious problems in the country.
James Fallows is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. The series that we do with him is called American Futures, with him and his wife, Deb, I ought to say. Jim, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks very much, Guy.
Coming up.
It's difficult to imagine that it was just one man, this young Italian, whose passion and vision were really responsible for revolutionizing menswear.
The it designer back before there even was such a thing as men's fashion, practically. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 247 points, 1.4%, closed at 17,737. Did the blue chips. The Nasdaq gained 89 points, 1.8%. 5,075. The S&P 500 added 33 points, 1.6%, 2,083 there. Railroads carry more coal than anything else, and coal shipments are weighed down. So Canadian Pacific Railway is looking to grow by buying a railroad. Last year it approached CSX. Now it's made an offer to Norfolk Southern. So far, Norfolk Southern's not interested, but its shares, oh, so interested, up 6.3%. Canadian Pacific up 5.8%. CSX up 4%. That's the whole industry right there, pretty much. Weight Watchers International made a strong presentation at a consumer conference. Shares jumped 11%, which is honestly not that big a deal these days, because in the month since Oprah Winfrey joined forces with Weight Watchers, the shares are up 300%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. His fate on the $10 bill is still apparently undecided, but Alexander Hamilton is making a whole lot of money on Broadway. The rap musical about the founding father of American capitalism has brought in more than $60 million in advance ticket sales so far. But as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports, it is not all about the money, you know. I'm laughing in the face of casualties of sorrow. The first
time I'm thinking past tomorrow. Yet numbers like that have Hamilton putting up numbers. It's fetching nearly $150 per ticket on average, putting it in Broadway's elite, well ahead of The Lion King and on the heels of the priciest ticket, The Book of Mormon. Hamilton built the foundation for the American financial system, but he has often been in the shadow of more famous founding fathers like Washington and Jefferson. After the show, audiences come out curious about Hamilton, like Julie Choquette.
I was on my phone during intermission to find out a little bit more. I didn't know his burial site was downtown. That's worth checking out.
We're standing here in front of the monument to Alexander Hamilton, who is the most famous resident of our churchyard.
Head all the way down Broadway to the corner of Wall Street and you'll find that grave. Trinity Church archivist Ann Petrimo gives regular tours. She's seen a big change since the musical became a hit.
There's usually people kind of milling around in the churchyard, and before they would sort of ignore me when I'm giving my tour, but now they're just like, oh, you're talking about Hamilton? And they'll come over and listen.
Visitors are now asking more detailed questions, including about lesser-known figures in Hamilton's orbit who show up in the play. And the connection to a hip musical is great for street cred. Petrimo now gets reactions like this when she answers the what do you do question.
Oh, you work at Trinity where Alexander Hamilton is buried? That's so cool.
We start right here in our lobby.
Elsewhere in the financial district, the Museum of American Finance is another place seeing visitor growth. It tends to fly under the radar, and its room dedicated to Hamilton is typically only one draw among various exhibits about banking, Wall Street, and money.
But as of late, we've had a large number of people that come in specifically for that exhibit.
Ben Urizar, the museum's assistant director of visitor services, is struck by how many more younger visitors are coming in.
The fact that it's a rap version has created a great impact because we have seen a large amount of young people, let's say middle school and high school age, come in here and saying we can identify with this character.
So Hamilton's grand plan was to have the government take over or assume all of these debts so that the United States would be considered creditworthy.
That's how a museum docent explains the famous debate pitting Hamilton against Jefferson and Madison. But in the play, Hamilton creator and star Lin-Manuel Miranda reimagines it as a freestyle rap battle.
A civic lesson from a slaver. Hey, neighbor, your debts are paid because you don't pay for labor.
Miranda says he was most nervous not on opening night, but when he did the show for a crowd of high schoolers. The scene covers a financial topic that is far from a crowd pleaser.
So when we did that first cabinet battle, which is about the assumption of state debt, by the way, people were screaming like they were watching 8 Mile for the first time, and that's when I knew we had something really special.
He wasn't the only one who noticed the play's potential to get young people excited about early American history. Recently, the Rockefeller Foundation set aside nearly $1.5 million to work with educational partners on a special American history curriculum that'll also bring students to see the play. More than just a giant financial success, the musical is also a powerful educational tool. Alexander Hamilton, with his passion for free markets and fierce appetite for learning, would probably approve. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Most of the time on this program, when we talk fashion, it's for or about women. Men, however, have their own styles, you know. I'm talking specifically suits here. There's the American cut, the English cut, and of course, the Italian cut. That last of which, says author Michelle Finnemore, we have one man to thank for.
A Brioni suit today is really the culmination of generations of innovation that Gaetano Savini Brioni inaugurated way back in 1942. Brioni, from a very early age, had observed that men's suits really looked too drab, too uniform. They were really too tightly fitted to a man's body. He couldn't really move in ease and comfort. He thought that men's wear really should be as interesting as women's wear, and why can't men wear color? Why can't they wear pattern? What was it that made this such a strict uniform? He introduced cuts that were much more comfortable for a man to move in. He introduced bright pops of color, both in the actual fabric on the suit as well as in the linings and in the ties. He really wanted to bring this idea of Italian post-war optimism, fine craftsmanship, and beautiful colors and textures to the American market, and it really was embraced. James Bond is probably one of the most famous filmic characters that wears Brioni. President Obama wears Brioni. Cary Grant, the Kennedy brothers, Charlton Heston and Henry Fonda. But then there are certainly businessmen who are only Brioni wearers. The introduction of the Italian cut really did change fashion entirely in many ways in menswear. It's difficult to imagine that men's fashion was actually an overlooked afterthought. And it's really even more difficult to believe that it was just one man, this young Italian, whose passion and vision were really responsible for revolutionizing menswear.
I think I have to go buy me a Brioni suit now. I don't know. Michelle Finnemore is the author of the new book, Gaetano Savini, The Man Who Was Brioni. This final note on the way out today, offered by way of saying, sadly, that the long-running hit game show What is Janet Yellen Thinking?, that we have been playing on this program for a while now, has most likely breathed its last. In the minutes of the most recent Fed meeting that were released today, Yellen and company said this. It's a quote, and it's Fed speak, so bear with me here, but here's the quote. Most participants anticipated that, based on their assessment of the current economic situation and their outlook for economic activity, the labor market, and inflation. These conditions could well be met by the time of the next meeting. End of quote. Binya Applebaum, who covers the Fed for the New York Times, tweeted this about that. He said it's the equivalent of the Fed standing up and shouting out loud that there would be a rate hike. Next meeting is 15-16 December. Go ahead and put that rate increase in your calendar in ink. All right. Now watch. They're not going to raise rates, right? Just watch. All right, we're a little bit tight. I got to go. The Dow up 247 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 89 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 up 33 points, 1.6%. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back tomorrow. Told you I was tight. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.